Hello, my name is Luke Hunt. This is another podcast for The Diplomat. Welcome to Beyond the Mekong. And with me today is Alan Parkhouse. Alan is a former editor of the Phnom Penh Post and the Khmer Times, and he has spent the best part of 20, 30 years as a journalist in Southeast Asia, and that includes working for mastheads like the Bangkok Post and Asia Times. Alan, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Luke. It's nice to be here.
It is. You've retired. We're up in Kampang Pat in northwest Thailand. Your best days are behind you as a journalist. I think you're the first to say that. But you were the editor of the Phnom Penh Post and the Khmer Times. What were they like, and what were the differences in terms of working for those papers?
They were chalk and cheese, really. I find it very ironic that the two surviving English language papers, I was running them both at different times, and I was in competition in the second paper with my first paper, which was in an unusual situation to be in.
Right.
But they were very, very different papers. Phnom Penh Post had a long history of roughly 30 years, and it was an award-winning newspaper. We won a lot of awards. In 26 awards we won from two different international media organisations in my time there, and the paper won more after that and a few before that. The Khmer Times was a newcomer, very, how could I put it, unprofessional in the fact that the basics of the newsroom weren't set up properly. They weren't doing the hard-hitting stories that the Phnom Penh Post had done. But the media landscape in Cambodia was changing rapidly at that time when I went back to the second time I went back to work for Khmer Times.
That was around the mid-2010s when another competitor, the Cambodia Daily, was forced to close after being hit with an exorbitant tax bill. And the Phnom Penh Post, a year later in 2017, would also be hit with an exorbitant tax bill and was forced to sell to government-friendly interests.
It was basically the Cambodian government slowly silenced the media. The Cambodia Daily was the first victim. And the Cambodia Daily was our big rival newspaper with the Phnom Penh, when I was at the Phnom Penh Post. And there was some very serious rivalry, but at the end of the day, they were both very good papers. The Cambodia Daily had a few advantages over the Post at the time, being registered as an NGO, so they had free access to feeds like the New York Times and various wire services that we had to pay for. But there was a healthy competition between the two. The Cambodia Daily was out of the picture by the time just after I went to Khmer Times. They got hit with the tax bill and were forced to close down.
Right. And you worked with some very good journalists, both Western and Khmer.
Yeah, particularly the Khmer journalist I was very proud of and still am. And there's some very, very good Western journalists work there too.
Both papers basically became venues for young journalists around the planet who wanted to cut their teeth as a foreign correspondent.
Not so much the Khmer Times. They didn't have many foreign reporters, nothing like the Phnom Penh Post had. But the Phnom Penh Post was basically a training ground for a lot of people that went on to do some very good things in journalism. And we had a lot of interns there. The owners at the Phnom Penh Post figured out it was much better to get interns and train them for a very low cost, some of which were subsidised by the universities they studied at. There was one in Hong Kong that we basically got most of those interns for free.
Right,
there was a rotation of them coming through.
Loose scholars from the United States.
Yes, and Khmer Times didn't have that. They basically stuck with Khmer reporters and a small handful of Western sub-editors to fix up the English, because these people were working in their second language. It was not easy for anybody.
Sure, and occasionally there were disputes.
Oh yeah, not just occasionally, there was quite a lot, particularly at the Phnom Penh Post. The Khmers would have their news meeting early in the morning and the young foreign journalists would sit in. And the young foreign journalists would say, I'll take that story. But they couldn't make the phone calls and they couldn't get the quotes because everything had to be done in Khmer at the local level. So they still had to work with the Khmer journalists. And there was a bit of bickering between the two sides, nothing serious. But I had a few of the Khmer people come into my office and said, oh, this guy's got his name on the story. But I got that story. I made all the phone calls. I translated all the quotes. I did all the groundwork and the hard work. This guy sat in the air-conditioned office and just rewrote what I did and put his name on the top.
It's not very fair.
No, that didn't happen a lot, but that happened a few times. And the Khmer Times, it was different because we had the Khmer journalists going out and getting the stories, working by themselves, and then writing it. And we had a couple of sub-editors who were very, and myself, who were decent rewriters to knock the story into shape if it needed it.
What were your favourite stories?
There was a lot of good stories, not so many at Khmer Times because of the publisher's strict direction. We couldn't be too hard. We tried very hard at the first time for the first year, and then the hammer came down on us a lot harder in the second year I was there.
Right.
But
the Phnom Penh Post?
Phnom Penh Post, we did some really, really good stories, and one I'm particularly proud of was a story about Cambodia started exporting maids to Malaysia, similar to what the Philippines do in Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
And they had these recruiting agencies around Phnom Penh who were training basically village girls on how to be a maid in a modern house with modern electrical appliances like dishwashers and things. And there was one big house we investigated, our reporters investigated, under the suspicion they were training underage Cambodian girls. And they were, and we got a great picture of, I think the girl was either 13 or 15, I'm not entirely sure how old she was, but she was underage. There was bars on the windows in this house, and their photographer got a picture of her holding the bars. It just looked like she was in a jail and staring out, and she had a really lost look on her face. And we ran that as a front page story with the picture.
There were a lot of problems with these kids too, in that they did come from villages. They didn't know what was expected of them. They didn't know how to use an iron.
A lot of them came from villages in the back blocks of Cambodia where there's no electricity and running water. And they're suddenly being transported in the middle of, you know, modern Kuala Lumpur, where they had everything. So they took a lot of training, but the story we ran that time caused a lot of waves. It won a prize too. It won a very big international media award. But the Prime Minister was moved by that story, and he put an immediate stop to the export of maids,
mm-hmm.
which resumed later on, but they had a crackdown on the recruiting companies.
Right.
And the underage girls were no longer being recruited after that.
And it has to be said as well that a lot of those issues, which at the time caused a lot of grief for the government, whenever there's grief for the government in Cambodia, they're jumping up and down and obscene phone calls at 2 o'clock in the morning, but the issue is that it's been resolved. You don't hear any of these complaints these days.
Yeah, I think it's good when you do a story like that and you actually, if something happens, you can change things. That doesn't happen very often in our game, as you know, Luke, but when you run a story like that and they suddenly shut everything down and they stop the exploitation of these young women, that was a result, you know. I thought it was a big result.
It was a similar story too, I think, with Blood Sugar, which was another one of your stories. Leon Fatt was running basically sugar plantations and employing young kids, and but the feedback from that and from Leon Fatt wasn't great, if I remember correctly.
Leon Fatt was a very influential, and still is a very influential, Cambodian businessman with connections very high up. And he put a lot of pressure on us after that.
Mm-hmm.
In various ways, like the advertisers would pull their advertising suddenly, and we'd get angry phone calls, and we'd swamp with angry phone calls, particularly to the reporters. And the Cambodian reporters particularly came under a lot more pressure than the Western reporters did over that story. But we ran with it, and it did make a difference. Another story that made a big difference, which was a good result for everybody concerned. Not only us, but of course the people, the young kids who were cutting sugarcane in the hot sun, which is not a great job. There are other stories too, so many of them. We did the Cameroose Tribunal, which was ongoing.
It was a long-running one.
Oh, it still is. We covered all sorts of things, like our friend...
It was necessary. I mean, I think what mattered with the tribunal was that all the evidence that was produced was put up there on the public record, and people know now what happened, which wasn't the situation 15, 20 years ago. And that's where English language papers reporting without fear and favour did a terrific job.
We had a small advantage with that because we had a Khmer language paper at the Phnom Penh Post too, which was started up by the new owners after Michael Hayes and Kathleen had sold it to the new owners, which I work for. They'd started a Khmer language paper, and that had enormous reach because a lot of Cambodians couldn't read the Phnom Penh Post or any of the English language papers, so they and it was pretty much a mirror of the English language edition. So that got a lot of information out to the local populace that wouldn't otherwise have got it. And as you saw at the Cameroos Tribunal, there was a lot of villagers and people that had lived through that era who came in to watch the proceedings.
It was 500 a day.
Yeah,
for a long time.
It was a lot. When I was out there with you and other people, I noticed a lot of people who were of the age that would have lived through the Cameroos period. And I think there was some, I don't know if closure is the right term, but there was some justice seemed to be being done for the things that they'd suffered.
For $200 million, the situation in terms of people's relationship with their past, I think it was money well spent.
Oh, yeah. And as you know, the general population was very traumatised in Cambodia after the Cameroos, and there were studies done that showed that the trauma had passed on to the second generation. You know, these young kids, it was very... they couldn't talk about it. They couldn't talk what happened to their grandfathers and their fathers.
Their parents and their grandparents.
The post-traumatic stress disorder the level was very, very high in Cambodia because of the hardships they'd suffered, the things they'd had to do to survive, and all the family members they'd lost.
You briefly mentioned before Michael and Kathleen Hayes, or Michael Hayes and Kathleen O'Keefe, I should say. They both arrived in 93 with the United Nations peacekeepers. They spent their life savings in starting up the newspaper, and that was then sold to Bill Clough in 2008. And only a few weeks ago, the current owners, and we're not exactly sure who they are, since it was sold to, all we do know is that there were business-friendly, government-friendly interests.
Yes.
They've announced the closure of the print edition. They say they're going to keep the online publication, cut staff by 60%. It seems like the better days of the Phnom Penh Post, although they were over some time ago, but it's pretty much gone now.
They were, and full credit to Michael and Kathleen, who took a huge gamble in starting that paper. And the paper was never very profitable under Michael or Bill Clough. And in my case, I didn't work for Michael. I worked after Michael had sold it to Clough and a few of his associates. But Bill Clough, I have to say, was a very generous man. He was a geologist and from the mining industry in Western Australia. So he didn't have a media background, but he had an appreciation of what the media did.
Under Hayes and O'Keefe, the paper came out once every 2 weeks, and Clough took it daily.
Yeah, he took it to 5 days a week, and that's when I came in just after that happened. I was hired originally as the managing editor, which in newspaper hierarchy means the number two, and I was hired by an Australian friend who was the editor-in-chief, but he didn't stay very long. He had a falling out with the publisher, not with Bill Clough. And he literally overnight he quit, and the next day I became the editor-in-chief and continued to do that job for nearly 4 years. But I had always given Bill Clough lost money every month, and he sent money from wherever he was in the world. We always got paid on time, and no one's salaries got cut, and Bill stuck with it right up until the government hit him with a huge tax bill.
The total was $3.9 million.
Yeah, I heard the same thing. I wasn't there when that happened. I'd gone to Khmer Times at that point, but I heard the same figure. And Bill reluctantly paid it. And from that point on, everything changed at the Phnom Penh Post. All the stories were toned down. A lot of the foreign staff left.
And this was at the time when there was a much broader crackdown occurring with opposition politicians rounded up, charged with inciting to overthrow the government, which there's absolutely no evidence to support those kind of claims. In fact, the claims became quite extraordinary and included the US government backing the opposition to oust Hun Sen, the then Prime Minister.
Well, by that point, there was no independent media left. The Cambodia Daily had been closed. Phnom Penh Post had been taken over and tamed, toned down. And Khmer Times was basically a government mouthpiece.
But you did try at the Khmer Times. I mean, there were stories in there that were controversial, were challenging the government. It wasn't all kind of sycophantic nonsense, which tends to be more what's happening these days.
No, Khmer Times, I was there for 2 years, and the publisher, who was a Malaysian guy, when he hired me, I insisted that he leave me alone and let me run the editorial and not interfere. And he did that for the first year. And we ran a lot of strong stories, particularly about the Sesan Dam,
right,
which was being built on the Mekong.
And the state of the Mekong is a hell of a story.
Oh, it's a disgusting story. It's just sad. It's just wrecked so many lives with what they've done. But when they were building that dam, they flooded a big area where a lot of ethnic people were living. And our reporters, two of my Khmer reporters, went in. They waded for 3 miles in chest-deep water because the valley was being flooded. And we got pictures of the villages with their houses half flooded and stories of their lives. They'd been there for generations. We had a series of stories on that stuff. And when I saw the pictures of these two reporters wading through chest-deep water, I said to them, just sort of jokingly, can you guys swim? And they both shook their heads and said, nah, but we got the story. And I thought, geez, that takes a lot of guts to do that. They just didn't walk 100 yards. They walked 3 miles following a rough bush track, chest deep in water, and they got through.
How did working in Cambodia compare with heading editorial teams in Thailand?
Very, very different. Thailand basically has a much freer press. There is one subject you cannot basically touch or do anything in depth, and that's the royalty in Thailand. But apart from that, nothing is nothing is untouchable. You can police corruption. There's a lot of corruption stories, which are still running in some of the press that remains today. And we had, on the Sunday Bangkok Post, we had a very good Sunday edition that I worked on for quite a few years with a very good Australian editor. And we had two magazines.
That was Paul Ruffini.
Yes, Paul Ruffini, yes. And by far, was probably one of the best editors ever worked anywhere in Asia. Mm-hmm. We broke all sorts of stories. We broke the famous cigarette police story in Bangkok, where the council inspectors who had uniforms very similar to policemen would see a tourist drop a cigarette on the footpath and run up and find them. It was all money going in their back pocket. This had gone on for years, and one day we just thought we should do something about this. That story broke the records in circulation for the internet. It was the most clicked on in the Bangkok Post history at that time.
I've always noticed what you're saying, differences between Thailand and Cambodia. If you write a story in Cambodia about corruption, they jump up and down and everybody's yeah. upset. How dare you say that kind of thing? And their next move is to point out corruption happening around the world. And my next move is to point out, yes, and it's being reported. And when it's reported, the government's expected to act upon it.
Yeah.
Kind of in one ear and out the other.
In Thailand, when you report a big corruption story and there's influential people or politicians involved, the usual response is, thank you for the great report and shining a light on this. We had no idea, but we'll launch an inquiry into it. And that inquiry involves several subcommittees and it just drags on and eventually gets forgotten about it. And no one follows up, a couple of years down the track when you ask, the committee's still meeting, they're coming to a conclusion soon. And that's the basic way they step around it. But they do acknowledge it and they do make a show of, this is not right.
It's not the sort of issue that's going to get you shut down or with a multi-million dollar tax bill.
Yeah. But in Cambodia, when you did those stories, and whether it was politicians or the influential businessmen connected to politicians, they got very, very angry with you, and there was angry phone calls, threats to shut you down, threats to take you to court. And if they take you to court in Cambodia, you're not going to win, because supposedly the courts are run by the government people. This is the allegation. I'm not going to say they are, because I can't prove it.
But, sure, there are issues with Cambodia in the lack of separation of powers in that, and they will claim that we have a separation of powers, and other people will say we're not so sure. Where in Thailand, that separation of powers can be seen, and in other neighbouring countries like Vietnam and Laos, they make no bones about it. They don't have separation of powers. Yeah. So at least you know where you stand.
Yeah.
But in Cambodia, it's an issue.
Yeah, it is. And in Thailand, it's an issue to a degree too. Not as bad as Cambodia, but when it comes to politics and the powers that be, a lot of the people in the public would accuse the courts of not being fair.
Right.
I mean, the last election was a good example in Thailand. The party that won the election is not in government. there was court cases and disqualifications, and they used the legal system to their advantage. And some say the people in the legal system leaned their way too much. That's one allegation. I can't say that's true because I don't know for sure. But
you can report the stories and people can make up their own minds, yeah. Which is what is supposed to happen in a democracy.
My old paper, the Bangkok Post, and Khao Sot, one of the Thai language papers, the Fresh News in English, they have an English language website and they report much the same thing, particularly on that recent election. And they leave it up to the public. But if you read the comments under the stories of the Bangkok Post or the comments on Facebook under the Khao Sot, stories on that subject, it's pretty much unanimous that, it's like a fixed horse race, you know?
So, right. And if you made those same comments on Facebook or online media in Cambodia, that would give you...
You'd be arrested.
You would be.
Yeah.
You know, prison is your next destination.
Yeah, yeah.
A long time ago, there was a senior boffin in the Cambodian government who complained to the American ambassador saying that the Cambodia Daily, the Phnom Penh Post, they're picking on us at the time. They're saying all these bad things about us and we don't like this. To which the ambassador replied, they say bad things about us too.
That's a good reply. Very good reply. The diplomatic corps in Cambodia, when I was running the Phnom Penh Post and Khmer Times, I got to meet a lot of the ambassadors and became friendly with quite a few. I'm still friends with one particular one from a Southeast Asian country I probably shouldn't mention, but he's in the other side of the world now. They're very, very well aware, all the ambassadors, of what the corruption and the land grabs and all the different things that are going on there. And they can't do much. They can report to their own countries, and like the EU has sometimes blocked aid for the garment workers or whatever, or cut back quotas.
Everything but arms.
Yeah.
Agreement which gave Cambodia tariff-free or reduced tariffs for their garments into...
Yeah, well, the garment...
In Europe, which was removed.
The garment industry was huge in Cambodia, and because of all the irregularities that went on there, we can say corruption, etc., they did move, but they're very limited what they can do.
Mm-hmm.
Cambodia has Big Brother China helping it out.
Well, it had Big Brother China, and that's changed again. Yeah, the economics of the region is it's unprecedented. At that crackdown, the Chinese were also starting to come in, and the Cambodian government and Prime Minister Hun Sen, the then Prime Minister, had a choice. You can continue to accept foreign aid or Western businesses, which where the money came through tied to human rights expectations, or you can
ours with no
strings
attached.
Yeah, exactly. And they opted for the Chinese money. The problem with that, of course, is the great exodus with COVID, and the money hasn't returned. And now the Cambodian economy is struggling.
It's like putting all your money on one horse in a race rather than spreading the bets out. You know,
and it's not even an each way bet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I haven't been back to Cambodia for quite a few years since I left Khmer Times, and I know things have changed there a lot. But the biggest change there is the total lack of independent media now. It's and there are Cambodian media organisations who have run stories and been disbanded, and been journalists have been locked up, threatened, and it's
also most of the media is online, and my guess would be 80 to 90% of that is pro-government, tell the good story, be the official mouthpiece. What kind of room is there for the Phnom Penh Post to step in and do the same?
Yeah. Well, I think the Phnom Penh Post stopped being an independent paper after Bill Clough sold it, basically. And, you know, we knew who the owners and the shareholders were under Bill. We knew before that it was Michael Hayes and his wife. Nobody knows who runs the Phnom Penh Post these days. No one knows who's been putting in the money, who's been paying the salaries. I know from talking to friends of former staff there that the last couple of years they've had their salaries cut by large amounts, they've laid off staff, they've been trying to save their costs.
Well, it's been heavily subsidised.
Yeah, well, it has been. It always has been. But the cost was the independent media. They can't run stories if whoever's subsidising gets upset. They're not going to be paying the salaries. And
who wants to read that? You have small circulations, no one wants to advertise.
Yeah, exactly.
There's no income.
Even in my time there, in Michael's time, there were small circulations, but they punch way above their weight.
Mm-hmm.
And when we won the and which you were a part of. We won the big gold award for the World Association of Newspapers for the 20th anniversary issue that you contributed to and a lot of other good people contributed to. We beat the Financial Times of England and the China Daily into second and third place. And we had a circulation that was minuscule compared to those. You know, we had several thousand circulation. Our print run was, you know, under 10,000.
I remember that day well. I was actually in Kabul and an old friend of mine, colleague, boss, Carl Wilson, was with the China Daily and he was sending me notes from, was it Bangladesh where the award was?
Bangalore.
Okay. And Carl was sending me notes from center stage to Kabul saying, congratulations, the Phnom Penh Post has won the award. That's how I think.
You know, when we went to the awards, I saw Carl for breakfast. I'm a friend of Carl's from when I worked in Hong Kong. And I saw him at breakfast with the China Daily people and we realised we're in the same category. And it was us and the Financial Times from the UK in the last three. And we went to the hall that evening where the awards were being handed out, Carl snuck in there behind the stage and had a look. And the trophies were all there. And right. On the big gold trophy for first prize was the Phnom Penh Post. And
that's how he knew.
That's how he knew.
I didn't know that.
And as I walked up to the hall, he came running over and said, congratulations. I said, what for? He said, you've won. I said, they haven't had the awards yet, mate. What are you talking about? He said, I snuck in and had a look. Your name's on it. The China Daily guys weren't very happy.
They were heady days. So the point with that award too was that you were always able to call on journalists who had a name for themselves. I mean, I'm referring to Tim Page, Nate Thayer, Michael himself was a big part of that.
When I did the 20th anniversary issue, I put the whole 83 pages together.
Which is what won the award, I should
quickly. Yeah, this is what won the big gold award. Which I might ask the Phnom Penh Post if they'll give it back to me because they're closed now and they've got nowhere to display it. But I'd be happy to display that in my place. But I had a couple of months to think about that and to get stories together because I knew I needed a lot of work, a lot of stories to fill up a big space. And that's when a lot of the people that had contributed to the Post before my time under Michael, people like Mark Dodd and Tim Page, the photographer.
Al Rockoff
gave me photos. Tim Page gave me a whole thumb drive full of his photos from Cambodia. And a lot of people like yourself wrote stories for it. And that was one of the reasons we won that gold award. We had such good writers and such good photographers. Right. I wrote the interview with Michael, which came out good, and talking about how he'd started it. And it was a funny story. He went to Cambodia during the UN time and he booked into a hotel and he was having breakfast the next morning and he asked for a newspaper. And they said, there aren't any. And he said, well, I might start one then. And that was what Michael told me, how he started the Phnom Penh Post, because there was no media there at the time.
There wasn't. And UNTAC was an interesting, eclectic bunch of militaries, police people from all over the world. And there was a market there for it then. Speaking of which, how do you see newspapers, online media shaping up over the next few years, decades from your perch here in Kampeng Phet?
Well,
on the Ping River, I'll add.
Yeah, thank you. It's going to be very difficult for good media organisations just to, you know, exist and to make money or break even online because, as my old boss Pichai at the Bangkok Post told me once, he said, when we have the print edition, we can do a double page spread of like a supermarket ad, full page colour, and we can get something like 120,000 baht for that. There's no ad you can put on your website that'll come anything over about $50. So there's a big, big issue there with the income. You know, newspapers made money from advertising. Websites, they can have a lot of ads on them, but the return on those ads is very, very small.
$50,
$20. Yeah, $50, $20. There's nothing much over $100 that people will pay for an online ad.
Yeah.
And unless to make your website long with a lot of stories, you need a lot of journalists, you need a lot of stories coming in. And if you're a daily one, that's even harder to have fresh stories every day. And that means a reasonably big size staff and you're not getting the income to pay even half of that staff a decent wage. So I don't think the outlook looks good. There are big organisations like say, the New York Times or the Washington Post in the US or the Times in London or the Telegraph. Some of the big international media organisations are making some money on their online sites, but they're selling their own advertising and to niche markets, basically.
You don't want to rely on Google Ads.
Google Ads paid very little. My last job was an online thing called Asia Times, which I'd worked for many years before when it was...
It's a very good publication.
When it was a print edition in the 90s in Bangkok, it was very good.
I thought it was still quite good as an online publication as well.
Yeah, it was, but they really struggled. I don't think they've ever really broken even. They've got Google Ads. They tried to sell ads out of Hong Kong and it didn't work. So they reverted to Google Ads, and I don't want to say the figures in case I get them wrong, but they're only covering it. The income they get from Google Ads is only covering probably two or three of the staff.
Well, at least that's some kind of staff.
Well, there's some, but it's the investors and the people behind that who are still, like Bill Clough was at the Phnom Penh Post, fronting up the money. And I stress again, Bill Clough, he spent a lot of money keeping the Phnom Penh Post going, but he had a belief in what we were doing. And even not being a media guy, he never once told us don't run this story or run that story or anything else. He left us alone to do it. And I respected Bill a lot for that. I never got called into his office to say, oh, I don't like this story, you know.
No.
He was very hands-off, but he was also very good at making sure we all got paid every month. And every month he had to dip into his pocket to keep that paper going.
That does help. Alan, you're now retired?
Yeah, happily retired. And my girlfriend and I are building a house and a restaurant, which she will run in Kampang Phet, where we live. And that should be finished. The restaurant is nearly finished. The house will probably be another month. Hopefully we'll provide for the two of us for the time to come.
The rest of your days.
Yeah, however long that may be.
Alan Parkhouse, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Luke. It's been nice talking as always. Thank you.